Case number 12-5349, KV Pharmaceutical Company et al. Appellant versus United States Food and Drug Administration et al. Mr. Cooper for the appellant, Ms. Wright for the appellees.
Good morning.
May it please the court, I'm Richard Cooper from Williams & Connolly, LLP, representing the appellants. First, I want to address the import issue, our claim that FDA, by policy and by individual actions, has been allowing unapproved 17P API into the United States. This court's decision in Cook versus FDA last July, recently reported in 733 F3rd at page 1, covers this case. That case involved not only a drug that was made in an unregistered facility and was misbranded, but also a drug that was unapproved. And the court at pages 3, 4, and 5 in 733 F3rd made clear, stated repeatedly that it was unapproved, and discussed the statutory provisions requiring approval of a drug. And then at page 7 of the opinion, the court said expressly that it agreed that FDA, quote, must refuse admission to any drug that appears to violate the FDCA, the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, close quote. That statement was not limited to a drug that's made in an unregistered facility. And the court made very similar statements at pages 9 and 11 of the opinion. So I would submit it is very clear that it suffices to trigger the requirement of refusal of admission that a drug is unapproved. Here it is undisputed that the 17P API coming into the United States from China for compounding is unapproved. And the government's brief at page 42 acknowledges that it's all imported. And therefore, under Cook, FDA is required, it has no discretion to abstain from requiring that the drug not be admitted. So Cook covers this case.
And what's the final agency action you're challenging on the import?
There are two final agency actions. The first is FDA's March 30th, 2011 statement, in which the policy of admitting the imports is implicit because it's implicit.
Because it says nothing.
But it's implicit because allowing the imports is absolutely necessary, absolutely indispensable to what FDA was trying to achieve, namely, quote, to support access to, close quote, to hydroxycaprolate. And what the agency was trying to accomplish, to, quote, support access, could not have been accomplished at all if there were no compounded 17P, and there would have been, and there would be today, no compounded 17P without the unlawful admission of imported API, an active pharmaceutical ingredient for that compound. And secondly, and this also has a parallel in Cook, we challenge the individual admissions. FDA's import bulletin, the one that's in the joint appendix, and the one that was sent to the court by the government yesterday, makes absolutely clear that FDA considers, focuses on, looks at every import of active pharmaceutical ingredient for compounding 17P.
Are you seeking the ban of the API import from unregistered manufacturers only or from all?
From all, because it's unapproved. Mm-hmm. It's unapproved and therefore is in violation of Section 355 and therefore must be refused admission under Section 21 U.S.C. 381. Let me read, if I may, a statement that the court made at page 11 of its opinion in Cook. Quote, the FDA's individual admissions of thiopental shipments were not in accordance with law because Section 381A requires the FDA to refuse admission to any drug that appears to violate the substantive prohibitions of the FDCA, and the FDA conceded before the district court that the thiopental in these shipments, quote, clearly appears, close quote, to be an unapproved new drug, close quote. That's true here. FDA, under the import bulletin, looks at every shipment coming in. FDA is looking at it only to see whether it's registered or unregistered, but FDA knows that it's not approved because it distinguishes these imports from the import for Makena, which is approved in the new drug application for Makena.
Would the FDA's response to your letter from Cook saying that there's a distinction because the drugs involved in were from unregistered manufacturers, whereas the drugs here are from registered manufacturers?
Well, the drugs here originally were from both, but the import bulletin is intended to take care of the unregistered.
So but all that's left is that we have to deal with it, the registered.
Yes, and I would submit that the government misreads Cook, because they read Cook as addressing only unregistered. And the sampling that's required by the second sentence in Section 381A, deals with unregistered. But the third sentence of Section 381A, which has the refusal of admission language, is independent of that.
But the sampling for unregistered is a requirement. I mean, that's what Cook held, right?
That's
for unregistered manufacturers, you shall take samples.
That's part of what Cook held.
Well, that's part of it. But for registered manufacturers, it's when the secretary does an examination. It doesn't say he has to take a sample of every drug that comes in from a registered manufacturer.
That's correct, but under the third sentence, if it appears from the sampling or otherwise that the drug is in violation of the statute, FDA must refuse admission. That's what the court in Cook said. That's the passage I read. So if it's unapproved, FDA must refuse admission. And here it's unapproved. There's no dispute that it's unapproved. And we allege in paragraphs 121 through 124 of our complaint, both the policy as implicit and the individual allowances of import. FDA, as in Cook, FDA is focusing on each shipment and knows that it's unapproved, and yet is admitting it, inviting flagrant violation.
It doesn't have FDA, according to your point, is that FDA doesn't have to take samples.
Correct.
They know.
Correct. And in I would note, just as a footnote here, it's a bit odd that the statute requires sampling from unregistered, because if it's unregistered, it's misbranded, and therefore in violation of the statute. You don't even need to take a sample. And the third sentence says, if it appears from the sampling or otherwise to be in violation of the statute, then you don't let it in. There's nothing more on that. I'll turn to the Heckler versus Cheney argument.
And here, if you win on that point,
I'm sorry.
Let's suppose you win on the point that you just made. The rest of the case disappears, doesn't it?
I think I don't know that it disappears, but that would be sufficient relief if FDA is, if the opinion of this court were to make it clear that FDA has to refuse admission of the.
There's nothing, well, there's something in the pipeline now that there'd be nothing left to compound, right?
That's correct. As far as the record shows. Now, whether some domestic firm has started up, I don't know. But the record doesn't show that, and I don't know it. But in terms of the record of this case, that's correct, Your Honor. On the Heckler versus Cheney point, the major point I want to make is that there is law here to apply. And that law comes not only from the statutes that we cite in our brief, Section 360 CCA, Section 355, and Section 353A, but also from a binding advisory opinion under FDA's regulations, 21 CFR 10.85D, David and E. Elephant, a statement in a Federal Register preamble by FDA is a binding advisory opinion. It is as binding as a regulation. And here FDA has said, and we quote it in our brief, and I can give you the language, that it does not have authority to take price into account in decision-making about access to an orphan drug. Quote, FDA does not have the authority under existing law to equate high cost with lack of sufficient quantities, even though cost may affect access to a drug, close quote. 57 Federal Register at 62084. It's quoted in our brief.
What do you do with the background principle of enforcement discretion that clearly informs Heckler? Comes from the Constitution. Presidents do it all the time, maybe not all the time, but to a lot, where they decide we're not going to prosecute certain kinds of offenses, criminal or civil, which right. I think undergirds Heckler, although there are some murky aspects of Heckler, I grant you. So what do you do with that background principle, though, and why doesn't that encompass what's going
because
on?
Because that principle involves exogenous wrongdoing, exogenous conduct, mm-hmm. not conduct elicited, stimulated, called forth by the government. What the government did here, what FDA did here in its March 30th statement, was not merely turn a blind eye to ongoing conduct. Because if there were sufficient ongoing conduct, quote, to support access, close quote, there would have been no need for FDA to make a public statement. FDA wanted to change the status quo. It wanted to bring new supply into the market that otherwise would not have come into the market, as the statement from Wedgewood Pharmacy makes clear. Why was FDA doing that? It was doing that because it had pressure from certain members of Congress who expressed outrage over the price.
Well, suppose the president says we're not going to enforce certain immigration laws and that will allow more people to come here and work. And is that what's different? Or maybe you think that's improper, too. What's different about what went on here?
A couple of different things. One is, if an agency is managing a transition from noncompliance to compliance, as we see in some of the cases mm-hmm. here, as you see in the Cutler v. Hayes, and as you see in the Jerome Stevens case, and in the Schering case, and some of the EPA cases, where you have an independent, exogenous situation of noncompliance, and the government is transitioning to compliance, that's mm-hmm. within enforcement discretion. The government can do that.
Mm-hmm.
If the government is simply not taking certain enforcement actions, again, as to independently generated conduct, that's within discretion. But when the government calls forth new unlawful conduct, that's eroding the rule of law. Mm-hmm. That's not protected. And if you look at the opening sentence in Heckler against Cheney, where the court frames the question, it says the question under review is whether an agency's decision to exercise its discretion not to take certain enforcement actions is judicially reviewable, close quote. That's an exact quote. That's the opening sentence of the opinion. So the way the court framed the opinion was whether an agency could exercise its discretion not to take certain enforcement actions against independent conduct. That's not what we have here. FDA went out into the public to call forth violations of the statute it's supposed to administer.
To what extent does your client have jurisdiction, authority, the power to bring actions itself to enjoin the sort of conduct that you're complaining about here?
There's well-established law that private parties cannot enforce the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act. Mm. That's settled law, been settled for decades. Whether we could bring some kind of unfair competition claim is not something that's I've looked at. That might or might not be difficult. Some courts, my understanding of that body of law is that if the agency has firmly taken a position on something under the Lanham Act or some state laws, you can implement that through an unfair competition action. But if FDA has not, if the court is called upon, if the court in the unfair competition case is called upon to interpret the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, it will not do it. I believe the state of that law.
On your distinction on calling forth new conduct, I just want to make sure I understand that. So suppose a U.S. worker is upset that immigration laws aren't being enforced and therefore they're losing a job because unlawful workers taking the position, is that, and because the laws aren't being enforced. Does the executive branch not have the discretion not to enforce the law because you're calling forth conduct that affects someone else?
No. If all, in your hypothetical, mm-hmm. all the government has done is nothing.
Right.
It has not enforced the law. That's within its discretion.
Okay.
But when the government goes out and solicits unlawful conduct, that's the distinction I'm drawing.
Solicits
unlawful conduct that otherwise would not occur.
Mm-hmm.
That would be our, if you reverse and remand, our burden is to prove that.
Right. Solicit unlawful conduct.
Yes.
Okay.
And our submission is that's what FDA's March 30th, 2011 statement did. That takes it outside the sphere of
what about the efforts at FDA after that to backtrack?
They had no effect.
Mm-hmm.
Zero effect.
They had zero practical effect?
Yes.
Would they have a legal effect, however?
No, because our submission is that FDA called forth this wrongful conduct. If the FDA's action initially on March 30th, 2011 was unlawful, was violated the APA, then the agency, as a matter of normal principles of equity, the agency has to undo the harmful consequences of that conduct and not just do nothing. And the statements that it has made have failed to undo the consequences of that harmful conduct. And our company ended up in bankruptcy. That's the result. I think I've reserved a few minutes.
We'll give you back 2 minutes.
Good morning. Abby Wright on behalf of the FDA. I think I'll begin with the Cook issue as well here. And I want to make clear that plaintiff's position, as they've articulated it here today, would basically stop compounding in the United States. As we explained in our brief, 80% of active pharmaceutical ingredients used in compounding come from foreign sources. Just 2 weeks ago, Congress reenacted Section 353A, and 353A says that bulk drug substances used in compounding can come from foreign registered manufacturers. So plaintiff's position, as they've stated today, is that all of those must be blocked at the border because they are unapproved new drugs. And we don't believe that Cook requires this court to so hold.
What does Cook require then?
So
distinguishing between registered and unregistered, is that your argument?
That's right. I think if we look at the Cook decision, page 17 of the slip opinion, it says, in sum, we hold 21 U.S.C. Section 381A requires the FDA to sample any drugs, you know, that come from an unregistered facility and examine those samples and determine whether those samples appear to violate the FDCA. So Cook was addressing a situation where drugs were coming from a facility that had not registered with FDA. The statute treats those facilities differently. It singles those out, requires FDA to request samples from those facilities. It does not do so with respect to drugs that come from registered facilities. So with respect
even to unapproved drugs?
That's correct. So as we explained in our brief, what's left when you take out the unregistered facilities issue is the statute saying if it appears that a drug violates the FDCA, then FDA shall refuse admission. And so FDA retains the discretion to determine whether a particular import is violative of the FDCA and has not done so here.
But
and
these
so
are, if these are new drugs and they're not approved, they violate the FDA.
They do. They, as we say in our brief, they are unapproved.
Where's the discretion in that?
The discretion is whether to look at a particular import and determine whether or not it violates the FDCA. And
the discretion is whether to say something. I'm not sure I follow that. In other words, if we don't say it violates, we look at an import at the border, if we don't say it violates the Act, even though we know it does, then we can let it come in.
Well, that's exactly what happened in this court's decision in Her Majesty the Queen. EPA statute said if there's reason to believe that an air pollutant will endanger health or welfare, then EPA had to take certain steps. And there was every reason in that case to believe, and the administrator of EPA, I believe, had even made statements saying this is a problem. And this court said, though that's a specific statutory finding that the agency retains discretion to make
it up. So you're saying they have discretion to turn a blind eye to illegality? Is that that's what it is?
They have the discretion to determine whether to examine a sample at the border and to determine whether.
But with Judge Randall's question, when they know it's an unapproved drug.
That's our position in this case, and I think we have to look at the compounding context. As I began, 353A plainly contemplates that there will be compounding with foreign active pharmaceutical ingredients.
That seems to be contradictory to the Cook, and I'll just read this, and you can respond. I'm reading from, I guess, a slip opinion.
Mm-hmm. That's what I have as well.
Okay, yeah, it's page 11 mm-hmm. at the end of that paragraph under number 2. That the FDA must refuse admission, this is under Section 381A, mm-hmm. must refuse admission to any drug that appears through the sampling process or otherwise to violate the Act. It's not just sampling. It's if it appears by sampling or otherwise. And we're in the or otherwise category.
That's correct. That FDA certainly can refuse admission without taking a sample of a drug and does so all the time with facilities abroad who they know have safety problems. They block admission without sampling. What the court's talking about there, they begin with the FDA must request samples of all drugs offered for import that have been made in an unregistered establishment. And the court says in Cook, we have a mandatory antecedent and we have a mandatory consequent. And that's Congress has set in motion a set of mandatory steps with respect to unregistered facilities, but they have not done so with registered facilities. And Congress understood that when it 2 weeks ago passed.
I want you to finish the sentence, but I just want to stop here. But because with registered, there's no mandatory sampling?
That's correct.
But in this case, that's irrelevant. You don't need sampling. We know it's illegal.
They don't need sampling in this case. That's correct. But Congress.
Now, what is the purpose of sampling in the statute?
With respect to unregistered facilities?
What's the purpose of sampling? Yes.
With respect to sampling,
to see what's there,
to see if it's lawful or not, to see if it's adulterated, purity, potency,
labeling. So you don't need sampling when you know it's unlawful. But you're saying because there's discretion not to have sampling, that there's discretion to allow unlawful drugs. Turn a blind eye to unlawful.
Any exercise of enforcement discretion is, in a sense, not going after illegal conduct. And that's FDA retains that enforcement discretion in this context.
So the shall means may because of some constitutional background principle. Is that what you're saying? Or?
The shall, I think there's lots of criminal statutes we cite in our brief where the shall is telling you, once you've made that determination, here's what you've got to do. And so once FDA makes a determination that it appears to violate the statute, what should FDA do? Refuse admission. So that shall is telling you what the remedy is.
Do you think FDA can find that the condition is met and then still not, and then still allow it in?
Well, I think that would be contrary. That's like the National Wildlife Federation case where EPA had made the requisite statutory finding and came to this court and said, sort of inserted an additional decision point, and this court rejected that argument. Mm-hmm. So I don't think we could make that argument. Our argument is the discretion hinges on that statutory determination, which this court said in Cook that if it appears implies discretion in making the substantive determination. And that's where we think the distinction in Cook really is that the sampling that Congress directed only at unregistered facilities triggers a series of mandatory steps that FDA must follow.
This really isn't enforcement discretion of the kind that's usually discussed in terms of bringing charges against someone or initiating charges, is it?
Simple
charges.
FDA's enforcement remedies can include seizures, injunctions, things like that. And so this would simply be not detaining, which is, I think, a similar kind of enforcement action.
Subsumed within the prosecutorial discretion?
Yes, that's right.
I interrupted you, and I apologize.
Oh, but
when you were about to say 2 weeks ago, Congress did what?
Congress enacted the Drug Quality and Security Act, which reenacted Section 353A, the compounding section at issue here, taking out the provisions the Supreme Court had struck down. And in that provision, it says bulk drug substances can come from foreign registered manufacturers. If this court were to hold, as plaintiffs urge, that all active pharmaceutical ingredients must be detained at the border, that provision would become superfluous. There would have been no point for Congress to have said that it could be foreign registered manufacturers. And so we think you should
completely superfluous. There'd be nothing.
There would be some that would be a component if it was itself an approved drug. So there's some compounding that, say, takes a tablet and makes it into a liquid.
Well, then it's not completely superfluous.
So in that narrow circumstance, perhaps not, Your Honor. But as the majority of
suppose that the foreign registered manufacturer that was importing active ingredients that were approved.
Well, active pharmaceutical ingredients themselves are not approved. Imagine a large vat of powder, and to be approved, it would have to have a dosage, it would have to have labeling, it would have to have all the things that FDA requires. So FDA doesn't approve active pharmaceutical ingredients. And the case Judge Kavanaugh mentioned, some compounding does take a pre-existing, say a pill, crush it into a liquid for a patient who can't swallow a pill, for example. But the majority of compounding is done from these active pharmaceutical ingredients, which are bulk, powders, liquids, et cetera, that come in and then are made into a finished product by the compounding pharmacy.
So if it's an unapproved drug, it can't be approved, right? The stuff we're dealing with here can't be approved.
That's right. They're not. It's not to say that someone could, I suppose, come to FDA and say, FDA requires that, that there be trials that prove the dosage effectiveness, that it be labeled for use. This is not, no one ever just eats or drinks these raw materials. So they're not the kind of thing that gets approved, which means that under plaintiff's readings of Cook, they're all unapproved new drugs, and that's in their complaint as well, that they would be stopped at the border under this reading of Cook. But we think 353A should inform this court's understanding as well of what 381A is doing.
Seems to be a large gap in the law here.
It's interesting that Congress chose to depend on FDA's enforcement discretion, but they clearly did because they know that these active pharmaceutical ingredients are coming in from foreign manufacturers for compounding. If I could turn briefly to the Heckler v. Cheney.
Was the amendment to 353A?
353A, and then 353B is the new provision.
Okay.
Which provides that compounding pharmacies can voluntarily choose to become outsourcing facilities regulated.
Has that been signed into law?
It was signed into law on November 27th.
Was it passed before Cook came down?
It was passed after Cook. That's right. Cook came down in July. So to turn to the Heckler v. Cheney, I just want to address one.
Is there anything in committee reports that identifies Cook?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor.
Did FDA bring Cook to the attention of the relevant committees of the House and Senate?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor. With respect to the advisory opinion that my colleague mentioned, that the price, just to clarify, the price issue there is whether price can be considered when FDA is determining whether to approve an orphan drug. It's not with respect to enforcement discretion or, I think, any of the issues we're talking about. Here, the background principles, as espoused in Heckler v. Cheney and this Court's decisions in Cutler v. Hayes, Jerome Stevens, is that agencies, and FDA included, have enforcement discretion. Cutler v. Hayes was a case where FDA had stated publicly, as this Court said, that it would not be taking action against over-the-counter drugs that were safe but ineffective, and this Court still held that the FDCA did not provide law to apply in reviewing the FDA's exercise of enforcement discretion in that case.
Do you think the executive can say we disagree with the policy reflected in the statute and therefore are not going to enforce it?
I think the executive retains broad enforcement discretion. I don't want to wade into any particularly thorny issues. I don't think we have those here. What we have is FDA ordering its priorities. The June statement says
its priorities, but don't you think there's a policy judgment that's undergirding this? I think we're ignoring reality a little bit if we don't recognize that, don't we?
With respect to the March statement?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the March statement, we can look at what it says, and it says to support access, and we know what the background is. We also know that plaintiffs were sending letters to pharmacies saying...
But it's essentially to achieve a larger policy objective that we think important, we're not going to enforce a law that Congress has enacted against violators of that law.
I think...
In other words, this isn't, we don't have enough money, I don't think...
I very much do think it's, we don't have enough money is a big part of it.
Well,
FDA has to focus.
I guess that's true for everything, but I mean, that's not, this is a blanket kind of decision, right?
If you look at the language of the statement, it says, at this time, under these unique circumstances, we will revisit this. It still makes clear that you've got to have an individually identified patient, you've got to have a prescription, and then after that statement, it was clear that pharmacies like Wedgwood Pharmacy, it's in the record, were saying, basically, we have a green light. And then FDA comes back and says no. And I think it's very clear. You look at page JA-277, the Q&As. Are pharmacies free to compound large volumes of hydroxyprogesterone caprate as long as their drugs are safe? No. The FDA does not consider compounding large volumes of copies to fall within the scope of traditional pharmacy practice. And the FDA laid it out very clearly.
JA-277?
Yes, that's correct. That's the Q&A is publicly posted that, and plaintiffs themselves after this, the press release and the Q&As said, this is you know, FDA's new policy makes clear that they view it as a new policy, makes it clear that they are able and willing to come after pharmacies that are compounding. FDA stated in its June statement that it was, going to focus on safety risks, which is precisely what it's been doing. Between October 2012 and October 2013, they've inspected 70-some compounding pharmacies focusing on safety, and that's where they're choosing to focus their limited resources and time.
If FDA discovered tomorrow a large manufacturing operation or the equivalent of a compounder doing that, what is that? We talk about enforcement action. Tell me what that means.
What are
the options? For FDA.
So FDA, I can tell you what they've been doing, which is they've been going in and doing inspections, issuing, I think they're like 46 letters. They issue letters saying, here's the problems we're finding. They sometimes issue public statements to the world at large saying, you should not get products from this pharmacy. And then usually the pharmacy will voluntarily, FDA can't force a recall, but the pharmacies usually voluntarily recall their products. So and some of those, several of the large recalls have included the 17P drug at issue here. A couple pharmacies.
If you were to prevail here, I don't understand why every agency couldn't decline to enforce the laws in its jurisdiction, under its jurisdiction against private violators. And maybe that's okay, but you're portraying this as fact-specific, but the principle that you're articulating would have pretty broad ramifications.
I think the principle I'm articulating is the principle articulated in Heckler v. Cheney. Mm-hmm. It's a presumption. It can be rebutted where Congress has made clear. So, and like, for example, in the Wildlife Federation case.
How would it be made clear on this particular?
If Congress enacted a new statute, mm-hmm. they could say, FDA, you shall go after this particular. I mean, they could make it very clear, very express that you will do X, Y, and Z.
They could say, you shall refuse admission to any drug that is that violates the act, right? And we really mean it?
Well, if they put that, if appears before that, Your Honor, it is our position that we retain discretion under if it appears. But it is a presumption that can be rebutted, and we would look in a particular case to whether Congress has spoken directly and expressly to that issue. If there are no further questions, we ask that the district court be affirmed.
Clean up points on if it appears. I would ask you to contrast that language in 381A with the language in 381B, if it appears to the secretary, that is, if it appears to FDA. The 2F to the secretary doesn't appear in subsection A, and if Congress adds words, they ought to be given some effect. And the absence of those words in A should be given effect, and that means it's an objective standard. Now, obviously, FDA can't act if it doesn't know that it appears. But the if it appears is if it appears to FDA, to a court, then FDA shall refuse admission. And here FDA knows. There's no question that FDA knows as to every shipment that it's unapproved. And once FDA knows under Cook, there is no further discretion. There is no discretion. FDA may have discretion whether to find out, but once it knows, and here it knows as to every shipment that it's unapproved, there is no discretion.
Theory, the only compounding that could be done throughout the United States is from domestic manufacturers?
No. Let me make one other distinction. We have no objection to traditional one-by-one compounding, which is what's protected by Section 350A.
There won't be anything to compound unless there's domestic manufacturing, right?
No, sometimes, as Ms. Wright said, you can take the approved drug and break it down in some way and compound it. You can start, you can use that. You don't need necessarily raw materials. You can change a...
But what percentage of compounding relies on that?
That's the only compounding that's protected by Section 353A, which is traditional one-by-one compounding.
What do you do with Congress's recent act, which seems
Let me address that.
Okay.
First, Congress amended Section 353A by removing the unconstitutional parts. Section 353A says that the approval requirement and certain other requirements don't apply to a drug that, quote, is compounded for an identified individual patient, close quote. Compounded for an identified patient. So the compounder has to know the identity of the patient when the compounding occurs. If this during this holiday season you go out to buy a present for someone, you know when you're buying it for whom it's being bought. It's not that it is dispensed to an identified patient or sold to an identified patient. It's that it's compounded for an identified patient. And the compounder has to know that identity either on the basis of a recent prescription or in advance of a prescription if there's been some prior history of compounding for that patient. But the identity of the patient has to be known to the compounder at the time of compounding, and you don't compound in batches, commercial size batches, where that's the case. Now, Congress added a new and so even if the raw materials are permissible under 353A, the compounding still has to be for an identified patient known and identified at the time of the compounding. The new provision, 353B, permits commercial scale compounding, but there Congress imposed stricter requirements for the active pharmaceutical ingredient. It must be on one of two lists that FDA prepares. One list is for API, active pharmaceutical ingredient, for which there is a clinical need. That's the statutory term, clinical need. And the second is for a shortage, for FDA's drug shortage list. And there's no reason to, it certainly said the 17P is not on any such list now, and there's no reason to think that it could qualify for such a list.
If the raw materials are being used for compounding, are those approved or unapproved?
No, they're unapproved, but 353A for one-by-one compounding exempts the compounded drug from 355, it doesn't have to be approved. And when the 17P API comes to import, if it appears to be in violation because it's not approved, but FDA sends notice to the importer, and under 21 CFR 1.94, the importer can submit to FDA a statement that it will be used for lawful compounding in full compliance with all the requirements of 353A, and that takes it out of 355, so it can be admitted. So FDA can admit it for lawful.
Can you give me the CFR cite again?
21 CFR 1.94. It's cited in our briefs.
Okay.
That's the procedure for an import. And the term used in the regulation is hearing, but it's not really a hearing as we understand it. It can be a hearing. It's at the option of the importer to present oral testimony or written testimony. It can be a letter. And an importer who knows it's coming can be prepared to do that.
How would that letter work in conjunction with 353A? The Chinese importer says, listen, Mary Smith in Topeka, Kansas needs an injection and a special compounding, so we want to bring in...
No, it's not the Chinese. Suppose I'm a pharmacy. I'm Richard Cooper Pharmacy, and I'm going to compound it for Mary Smith. and my order of the 17P API is coming in to import, FDA stops it because it appears to be in violation. FDA sends me a notice that it's being held at import. I then submit a letter to FDA explaining as persuasively as I can that I'm a pharmacist. This is for Mary Smith. Here's a copy of the prescription. She needs, the doctor noted on the prescription, she needs a compounded version of Makena because she can't take one of the, she can't absorb one of the inactive ingredients. And here, and I'm going to compound it. And the quantity coming in is enough for one patient. I've removed the appearance that it's unlawful. It's now within 353A, and it's permissible. That's how it would work.
But now it's being imported in bulk, the 17...
Well, if it's going to be, it's, yes, it's being imported in commercial bulk for companies that make it for thousands of people, complete outside 353A. That's not traditional compounding. That's not what Congress intended to exempt.
Can I ask, Mr. Wright?
Sure. Yeah.
Thank you very much. We
Thank
ask that you reverse.
Thanks, Mr. Gibbs. Yeah.
One question. So I think I'm clear on this, but just to be clear, suppose we were to conclude, I'm not saying we're going to, but suppose we were to conclude that the statute overrides the enforcement discretion, you're not asserting some constitutional problem with that, are you?
No, we've not made a constitutional argument.
Okay.
Case is submitted.